Welcome back. Technical issues already. It's terrible. But greetings to all our beloved BTR family, and welcome to another edition of Mad Monday, a Mad Monday edition of Let's Talk with Eric Jackson. Mr. Talk, of course, won't be joining us today, so I hope you guys don't mind me filling in temporarily. This is Cloud Nation broadcasting live and direct. Today's show is going to be an open forum discussion, so if you have something on your mind and you want to hear, we want to hear from you, you want to share it, we definitely want to hear from you. Definitely call in at 347-838-8622. That again is 347-838-8622. Press button number 1 to talk, and we will open up the mics. But before we get into today's discussion, one of the things we definitely want to do is listen to a little bit of music. If I can get the technology to respond correctly, we'll get the music followed by reading a few headlines, and then we'll get into the discussion. We are fortunate, I believe, and privileged to be descendants of a rich lineage and royal bloodline. On this very day, I celebrate the spirit of our ancestors and the heritage of past and present-day elders, patriarchs and matriarchs from Africa to the Caribbean to Asia and even Europe. I want to thank the veterans and the sharecroppers, farmers and blue-collar workers, the governors of our households, also known as housewives and husbands, single mothers and fathers, teachers and griots, entrepreneurs and builders, and everyone yet to be mentioned. Thank you for all that you've done and continue to do every day. Builders of the pyramids, pioneers of math and science, the innovators and inventors, the historians and architects, authors painting vivid images of reality before us, and physicians healing us with the nutrients of the earth and remedies passed down through generations. Thank you, Mother Africa, for birthing the iconic founders of a complex civilizations, revolutionary culture, and innovative technologies that transcend the barrier of time and space in the very timelines. May you receive the credit that is due to you sooner than later. We still can taste the sweet taste of your proverbs, the echoes of your wisdom. Your spirit and nature still consumes us like a mighty rushing wind today. Hopefully we can get this technology going because it is not responding as I would prefer. A big shout out to Enjoying Life, to Rich Sister, to everybody in the chat room, guests TN27 guest 1017, and I know there's more people coming. You know, since the technology doesn't want to respond, I guess one of the first things I should do, perhaps, is just go ahead and read an article or two, and maybe that'll work out for us. So, yeah, I think a few people are ready to hear a little bit of good news. So, you know, we talk a lot about the downside of life and some of the negativity that may have taken place, you know, in a variety of different circles and spectrums. So I just want to touch on a few things that fall in line with the intro music, which is happy. And, you know, we should be happy. I mean, I know I'm happy. I appreciate life. I mean, I'm happy to be alive. I'm happy to have woken up yet another day, because there are many who did not have that opportunity nor privilege to see yet another day. I'm happy for the love and affection that I was shown by family members, mentors, people who have pulled me aside and shared and partaken their wisdom upon me. I'm happy and grateful for the elders who never look down on my youth, but instead see the best, the brightest, and limitless potential in many of us. I'm thankful for a loving mother who could have been like many of the statistics who have fall prey into, you know, going through with abortions. Not knocking those people who have, but the fact that she did not. I'm thankful that I was given that opportunity to have a presence and be present in this place we call life. I'm thankful to be a partaker in the life experience, and man, and so many more things. I could go on and on talk about being thankful, but I want to talk about some. I want to read a few very, very, very good things. I'm gonna just call it good news, you know. So, what's the good news? What's the good news? Some good news is this: there are some fascinating things happening in Mother Africa, Kenya in particular. Some young inventors, they say, may just change the very future of Kenya's security. Four Kenyan students from the Department of Mechatronics Engineering at the Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology are making the process of entering a building easier with the help of their security system. One, Michael Mumo, who is 21, Emmanuel Kinyanju, who is 22, and Ian Bett, who is 22, are all creators of a new security system that can be used to identify everyone who enters a building using near-field communication, or also known as NFC technology. Now, the system uses contactless technology that can also be used to automatically control the number of people who access public places. Now, once Kenyatta shifts to using the ID, the young inventors they say that the system will work even better. Now, the system currently involves a server, and they say that we are currently using a laptop which records all details, including ID number, time, and date of entry after you tap your ID on the reader module that will be placed at the entrance of public buildings, said Kinyanju to the Standard Media. He said, with this, we shall be able to know who went where and at what time, helping security organs with intelligence gathering. The idea for this security system came about when they were watching the news, and people were being arrested for interrogation at the scene of a crime while the police looked for suspects. Their words, not mine: with our system, it will be easier to identify suspects, since the data at the central server will reveal who was at the scene if a crime happens in or near a building with our system at the entrance, said Mumo. The police will only be required to retrieve data from the servers, call the individuals in for questioning, or track them down instead of arresting several hundred innocent passerby. Now, this new security system will not infringe on Kenya's privacy policy. The young men said that we will not be interfering with your right to privacy, but we'll touch on it a bit to ensure the security of the country. Recently, the student system won the Intel Galileo competition, which brought 113 participants from three universities. Go ahead, y'all. They're doing the thing most indeed in Kenya, Africa. And I decided to touch on some stories, some good stories that we often don't get a chance to get, and I noticed that there are some fascinating stories going on right in what many of us call the motherland of Africa, and that really takes to a whole nother level and totally obliterates the old, outdated images that many of us have been taught and shown regarding starving, malnourished children, desecrated communities in Africa, as though there wasn't another side, like as is in the U.S. and other parts of the world, where there are thriving, successful, in a phenomenal and wealthy, wealth in abundance crop of talented people doing some fascinating things around the world, including in Africa. Another good story is that this story about a young man doing some innovative things with video games. Now, I don't know how many of you guys are into games, but if not, I'm sure you know some young people that love them. I like video games personally. I don't spend a lot of time on them, but I still like them. And so there's a Nigerian creator of games by the name of Olankunle Ogbamule, and he's ready to take on the challenge of making his new mobile phone game, Afro Fighters, just as popular as his predecessors or games like Clash of Clans, and many of you guys definitely know about this, whether you play games or not, Angry Birds. So in order to do this, he has to deal with the obstacles holding up Africa's game development industry. For those of you, you probably said, I didn't know Africa had a video game industry. Well, that's good, because those challenges include mobile phone connections, subscriptions, and surrounding infrastructure. Now, according to a report from tech company Ericsson, industry analysts predict that by the end of 2014, mobile telecoms in Africa will have 635 million subscribers and 930 million by the end of 2019. Now, however, the number of expensive smartphones that can run sophisticated games and applications is low. So by the end of 2014, they will account for only 14% of African mobile connections. That is the number one obstacle. It is changing rapidly, though, says this young man of Kayulu Games in an interview with Reuters. 80% of Kaluya's revenue comes from making branded mini games and apps for other companies, at this time, rather than advertisements and purchases in its own titles, unfortunately. And so, what this young man says is that he would like to see more deals with telecom companies to let him process payments, more skilled developers, and better and cheaper mobile broadband, and possibly one day more funding to make full-blown console games for the Xbox and PlayStation. He would also like for his customers to have bank cards and accounts that would make it easier for them to send small payments for charge-ups and extra characters in games. Now, in Aruba, developer Moware Kiroru, who owns Planet Rockets, splits the time between designing games and running an advertisement company. As of right now, advertising clients get the bulk of his attention. And he says, his words, not mine, "I don't think anyone in Kenya can make a living out of gaming yet. We are just at our infant stage in terms of what we're doing, but we are in for the long haul. Planet Ruckus game, MA3 Racer, sends rickety minibus taxis zigzagging across a motorway next to a park filled with lions. The first edition of MA3 Racer 2D mobile game had more than 1 million downloads on Nokia's Ovi platform, showing a strong demand." Now, on Kaluuya's website, there are just 50 titles, and the highest ranked in the Google Play Store are Afro Fighters and Kiki, popular in India, where a player guides a rickshaw taxi down a dirt road. Ghana's Letty Arts company has a mobile comic strip combined with games like Africa's Legend in Enense Origin. Now, the idea is to bring in local players with local content who are always looking for a storyline that could turn into a franchise popular enough to cross borders in Africa and beyond. The people behind the company also want to change the way Africa is portrayed in Western games. So their words, not mine, "There are lots of African stories that haven't been told. With Enense, you have a very cunning character with spider-like powers from days of ancient Africa before Spider-Man existed," said Wesley Kurianye, Letty co-founder. Wow. Before Spider-Man, I don't know if y'all caught that, but they said Spider-Man is a pretty big franchise, and Kenya has a character that's basically pioneered that concept before Spider-Man. So, and we know how huge. Marvel and Capcom and Spider-Man and all those type sorts of characters are, but man, I just get excited about looking at the promise of things that is happening in the beautiful motherland of Africa. I think my music is ready to work now, so we might get a little song and dance, so to speak, for a moment. So I hope you guys can bear with me on that. And so, yeah, we'll do that. We'll listen to some good tunes. I'm thinking, how about some Nia Simone? You know, that I think that might work. It's been a while since we heard some of that. So maybe we should do a little Nina Simone, and you know, I think it's time to feel good. Don't you guys think you feel like feeling good? So since we're in a feel good mood today, I think it's only right that we listen to Nia Simone's "Feeling Good."
Just flying high, you know how I feel. I'm in the sky, you know how I feel. Ooh, just fly on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. They set me free. You know how I feel. They're running free. You know how I feel. Blossom on the street. You know how I feel.
Can I say, I mean, talented women, queens, giants in music, more than just entertainers. Their talent transcends beyond time and space. I mean, these women, their impact, their lyrical content, their talent, I mean, it's heavy. It's weighted. And there's people even today that are trying to attempt to get near those ladies' legacy, but you know, It's just not going to happen. You know, more good stuff, because we're happy today. This is a happy Monday. I know we call it Mad Money, but it's a happy Monday. Maybe we should say Magnificent Monday, but so it's a lot of good stuff going on. And since we're doing a good news check-in, I have some more good news to share. If you have some good news that you want to check in and share with us, please do not hesitate to share that information with us, because, you know, we have no problem with listening to. Call in. I mean, don't be scared. You know, call in, share your thoughts. The number is in the chat room. You see it, 347-838-8622. Press button number one, if you want to chat with us, and we will welcome that discussion. So this amazing and fascinating story is actually a story that talks about some of the amazing investing opportunities taking place in Africa. You know, investing in infrastructure, you know, Sub-Saharan Africa's top five opportunities out there right now. This report is brought to you by Ventures Africa. It's a July 10 publication. Is the date of this particular story and article. So, let's see what we're going to do. Ah, here we go. Now, starting with this particular publication, you know, previously published an article titled Public-Private Partnerships, Sub-Saharan Africa's Top Five Opportunities, in which basically highlighted the best countries for public-private partnerships or triple P's or PPP's, whichever you like, in Africa. Now, this particular article attempts to examine the best countries for infrastructure investment. If we assume all things to be equal, then each country's PPP system. So only one country, Nigeria specifically, makes it both top five lists, largely because its government has made amazing strides in recent years to match its enthusiasm for infrastructure with the demand for infrastructure investment within the country. Now, over time, all political indicators point to greater PPP environment in the other four countries and greater growth in PPPs across the continent. Still, in the short term, private investors should not be deterred by the challenges in the PPP markets, as officials in each country on the list indicate a desire to bolster the PPP market, especially from a legal perspective, and participate with investors. Angola. Now, more than 10 years after a 27-year civil war, that nearly 1.5 million people dead, Angola is taking off like no other country. Situated on the western coast of southern Africa, the country is home to a wealth of natural resources, most notably oil, making Angola the second largest oil producer in sub-Saharan Africa. I know that's a fun fact. A boom in real estate construction, including hotels and financial services, unsurprisingly, accompanies of the oil boom, all but making Luanda unrecognizable from 10 years ago. So on the surface, it is a perfect turnaround, but as it goes in any other country, every boom has its challenges, right? The all-encompassing challenge in Angola's growth story is infrastructure. New buildings, more people, and a deficit in power sums it up, says a major Lusophone private investor. Hydropower is an obvious solution, and the government is making great strides in restoring its capabilities. Still, the hydropower facilities and great distribution systems for power remain a shell of themselves after their decline in the Civil War. So, and another one is Mozambique. You know, Mozambique is a is the other big country in Southern Africa. Mozambique also shares a similar story of civil war and decimation, booming with gas reserves and the accompanying real estate sector. The country is in great need of transport upgrade. Recent estimates by PwC, a consultancy, values transport projects in the pipeline of U.S. dollars, $17 billion, including increased rail links to the ports and expanding port capabilities or capacities. Yet, by all accounts and estimates, more money will be required to ensure that major ports, including Nacala, Beira, and Makose, reach full potential. Equally, transport networks from those ports of neighboring Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Zambia require financial or financing currently not available in the market. You know? So, another one is Cote d'Ivoire. Talk of a country booming under the public radar. Cote d'Ivoire has made amazing strides since the assumption of power by President Alassane Ouattara in 2011. The economy expanded 9.8% in 2012 and 8.7% in 2013, with an estimate 8.0% predicted in 2014, according to the IMF. Yet it remains a fragile state, especially in with the elections around the corner. All right. It's some awesome information. The next one is Nigeria, one of my favorites. As mentioned before, Nigeria is the only country to appear on both the top five lists for public-private partnerships and top five lists for greatest infrastructure opportunity. Easiest way to explain that occurrence, is that Nigeria has one of the greatest infrastructural needs of the continent, particularly due to its size and population, and its politicians recognize this grave infrastructure challenge, consequently enacting laws to promote public-private partnerships across the country. The estimated cost of infrastructure investments required over the next 10 years hovers between $10 billion. The newly established sovereign wealth fund for the country cannot pay the bill for everything. Thus, private investors will have a wealth of opportunities to keep picking from in the near future, especially in Nigeria's power and accompanying transport sectors. Recent laws and change in government approach has numerous private operators waiting at the gates to make a deal. Fun fact about Nigeria, real quick. You know, looking at a lot of the generators that are about in that particular country. You know, the opportunity for solar energy. Just a fun fact for you guys, you entrepreneurs in the world. Fun fact: solar energy and alternative energy methods are it's a lot of opportunity for energy growth, for alternative energy growth out there. So if you are in the energy industry or alternative energy industry and you're looking for a market to really wet your beak in, I would personally recommend Nigeria. Trust me when I tell you, it's a nice market. Solar energy is doing pretty well there. So it's definitely worth the look. Another good story is, I got another one that I'm going to pull up, and I'm going to put the number out there again to remind you guys that if you want to call in, please do, because this is an open forum, so it's really about you guys and what you guys want to talk about. So I'm hoping you guys will share your thoughts. 347-838-8622. That's 347-838-8622. The number is also written in the chat room. Press button number 1 if you want to chat with us. And I look forward to chatting with you, hearing your thoughts, hearing what's on your mind. Remember, it's all about you guys. So call on in. This is open forum. I know you guys have some thoughts on your mind. I'm sure you guys had some things going on during the weekend, and you might want to share some of that. I don't care if it's sport-related or whatever. You know, you got some stuff on your mind. Definitely, definitely share it with us, and we will be happy, more than happy, to chop it up with you guys on here. I got another story that I'm going to definitely put out here in a brief moment. And it's a very, very, very interesting story that I recently came across. Wonderful, in fact. Wonderful. Ah, here we go. Five black child entrepreneurs. Five African-American children entrepreneurs your children should know about. Yeah, five entrepreneurs. These are some kids doing some fascinating things. I read one story before with a fresh crop of young entrepreneurs. Here's another one. Here's a different one this time. This is, we want to start it off for one of the more well-known kids. You've seen this kid on an Oprah Winfrey show. You've seen him on Shark Tank. A youngin by the name of Mosiah Mo Bridges. At age 11, young Mo in Mo's Bows. Ever since he was 4 years old and dressing himself, Mosiah Mo Bridges, now 11, insisted on wearing a suit and tie whenever he could, even to the grocery store or while riding his bike. He says, his words, not mine, "I love dressing up," says Bridges, who found early inspiration from his father and grandfather, who typically wear three-piece suits for no particular reason. Who says that you can't model good habits before children and then pick it up? "I look and feel so much better in nice clothes," he says. "It makes me feel like an important person." At first, his mother and grandmother helped create the merchandise, which they sold to family and friends as the business increased through Facebook and Etsy store and word of mouth. So did the production team. Now his other granny, aunts, cousins, and friends help him make bow ties as they sit around Bridges and his mom's dining room table. Sometimes he'll walk around the table and say, "How are my workers doing?" He is the CEO of Mo's Bows, after all. So Mo's Bows is a fascinating one. I'm going to put his information in the chat room right now for those who may be interested in reading this particular article yourself. Another young lady is a lady by the name of Chantel Song Bimbri. Now, this 14-year-old queen in the making has a business by the name of Honey Bunch Kids. Now, her mission is to provide quality literature that entertains and educates children between the ages of 7 and 12. For you guys who have children or family members who are kids, here's some great information. If you grandkids and so on, to launch a literacy campaign that will one day change the way children think about reading, to inspire children to set goals for themselves. When you think of an author, the team entrepreneur, the term entrepreneur doesn't necessarily come to mind, but more book writers are beginning to realize that being an author takes a certain entrepreneurial spirit if you really, and I do mean if you really want to move volumes. Just ask 14-year-old Chantel Song Bimbri, who sold more than 500 books last year and is aiming to double that with the release of her second book this fall. Third one is Lena Archer, who started at 8. Now, she has a company that is called Lena's Hair Incorporated. Yeah, Lena's Hair Incorporated. Now, what Lena's Hair Incorporated is about is, some of it is obvious, but when she was 8 years old, and was named, Incorporated.com magazine's youngest 30 entrepreneur under 30. She using a family-made for hair repair, what she did was she began her career by selling her product to fellow students. Now, the buzz spread, and soon orders quickly were coming from stores across the U.S. and online. Meanwhile, Lita Steele has time to develop new products, make the honor roll in middle school, and she's even been offered a scholarship from Harvard. Yeah, that's the Harvard, for those who were wondering. Not Harvard Community College, but Harvard University. And she delivers motivational speeches also in communication skills for parents and teens to live dreams their own and start businesses. You know, live their own dreams and start their own businesses. That's what I think they intended, they really meant. Umar Brema. Now, Umar Brema has a company called Umazu Anim Shop. Now, at the age of 12, Umar Brema, he runs his very own Anim store called Umazu. His name is, it's in Japanese. And he opened a new shop in Cape Girardeau. I'm not going to even try this, but it's in Missouri. turning his hobby into business, his mother put up $10,000, just $10,000 bucks, not a whole lot, but just $10,000 bucks, and so she put up the $10,000 as an investment, considering the internet is one of the only places you can find Anim. Some products can end up costing twice the price plus shipping charges. So Umazu offers collectors a place where Anim, they will have to pay additional money to get what they want. And Umar one day hopes to expand his business to a chain stores. These are some incredible toys that this kid has. It's quite fascinating, I must say, quite fascinating. And so you have Jaden Wheeler and Amaya Selman, 12 and 11, these two children, fascinated. Oh, they have a company called Cool Kids Snow Cones. Yeah, I said it, Cool Kids Snow Cones. Now, Jaden Wheeler and Amaya Selman are the youngest owners of a food truck in Memphis, Tennessee, and by a few critical years. Neither is yet a teenager, as you guys can see. And the brother and sister team own and operate Cool Kids Snow Cones, a little enterprise that started in their front yard 2 years ago. Their words, not mine. We were always asking our mom for stuff because we wanted her to buy us toys and things. And she said, why don't y'all make your own money, Amaya said. So I said to do a lemonade stand, but Jaden said we wouldn't make any money. And he wanted to do a yard service. But Mama said no, because he could get hurt. They love Jerry's Snow Cones, a good drive from the Southeast Memphis home. Their Southeast Memphis home, and they spurred that idea. So the children are the future of the black community, obviously, and so let's be sure to inspire them to continue reaching for the stars and getting good grades, learning, and to become entrepreneurs. They're doing fascinating things with this particular company that they started off the ground. I'm going to put this particular article in the chat room for you guys if you want to see that, share it with some friends and family, inspire some children There you go. What else do we have? What's the good news? It's a lot of good news. Here's a little bit more of some good news. And I'm really waiting for the phone lines to light up, but they have yet to light up. Wow, chat room is busy though. And I guess it's feeling a lot like Troll Monday a little bit. So I guess that happens at times. But yeah, so. Here's a good story, and I want to shout out to all the wonderful listeners that we have that typically come in and out and are here today, who are here to partake in substance, not to be modelers of tomfoolery. I'm shouting you guys out. This particular story and wonderful piece of good news is, I got to read this. This is cool. It's intra-regional trading in Africa. Yes, yes, more stuff in Africa. That's right. How many times do we hear Africa? Not much in our news, unless it's something negative. So I figured let's talk about the good news. Now, here's a little good news that's going on in Africa as we speak. And I mean, this is some interesting and cool stuff right here. Ventures Africa is where I got the story, for those who wonder. It says a lot has been done, has been said, and written about Africa with respect to investments, exports, and trade with the international community. There are also abounds opportunities for Africa if she can boost trading within her borders. Okay, I don't know what that's about. The structural fundamentals for this are in place already, as Africa has over 10 economic unions and trade groups. However, intra-regional trade has remained low and occurs mostly in the southern African region. Less than 17% of all African imports and exports occur within its borders. Other emerging regions have as much as 24% to 30% of intra-regional trade. Within Africa, the bulk of the trading occurs in the south, 51%, followed by the west, 28%. The eastern region contributes about 12%, while the north follows with 6%. The least trading occurs in the central region, 3%. Countries like Kenya and Senegal have their largest export markets within Africa. Increase Africa's intra-regional trade is a viable path to boosting economic fortunes and provides more growth. If larger regional markets were developed, a number of structural and competitive advantages could ensue. Oh, man. Fascinating stuff happening in Africa as we speak right now. I'm going to put this one in the room, too. And you know what? Now, I've did a lot of good news. And so now we got to look at some interesting stuff happening. This isn't the good news anymore. This is just stuff that's happening around the world. And I wanted to look at a particular story right now that's happening because it deals with our education system. And everybody knows how much we like to talk about our education system. So I actually have an interview with a phenomenal group of people. And I want to go to that interview and share that with you guys because I thought this particular information was quite fascinating, as they are pointing out $32 billion for-profit college industry becomes pass-through for Wall Street. That's the title of this article. So we're going to listen to this for a second, and hopefully somebody calls in and you guys share some of your thoughts, because I want to hear from you guys. Really.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Jessica Devereaux in Baltimore. And welcome to this edition of the Ford Report. Now joining us is our guest of honor, Glenn Ford. He's the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. Thanks for joining us, Glenn.
Oh, thank you.
So, Glenn, this week you're working on an article about the for-profit college industry. Can you describe a little bit about what your article is about?
Well, we've got a crisis that's approaching, and it's a crisis in two parts. Part of the crisis is for Wall Street, and we're not really worried about that part. These for-profit colleges, which collect between them $32 billion in federal student aid money of one kind or another, these are actually not educational institutions. They are set up as pass-throughs for those federal money. And so the absence of these institutions may, in fact, be a very good thing. They sap what little economic vitality is left in poor and black communities by stringing out people on years of debt and giving out diplomas when people do manage to graduate that aren't worth much in the workplace. But the other part of the crisis is the one that hits those people who are the students, who have flopped to these institutions because nobody else was serving them. And that's why they were a group to be plundered by these shysters they quartered on Wall Street.
Well, let's name some names back. We're talking about the University of Phoenix. Who are we talking about here?
Well, the University of Phoenix and an outfit called the Ashford University actually produce the most black bachelor's degree of any institution in the country. If you're looking for people who are handing out degrees to black folks, it's not Clark University, it's not Morehouse, it's not Howard, it's Ashford and the University of Phoenix. So these are pretty well known if you watch television. These are organized hucksters who have tapped into a huge demand in black America. In the first decade of this century, black enrollment in these for-profit universities, like the University of Phoenix, went up 235%. Black enrollment in colleges in general, in all kinds of colleges, for-profit and traditional, went up 35% in that first decade. And most of that enrollment was into these for-profit colleges. And that tells you that the existing educational structure is not serving that particular community and is therefore complicit with driving literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of poor people and aspiring people into the clutches of folks who are nothing but rip-off artists who want to be sent to jail.
Right.
The first victim, we hope they are a victim, is Corinthian, which is not the worst of the for-profit institutions. It's got about 70,000 students. It has 100-plus campuses around the country. It gets 83% of its revenue from the federal government. And when the feds were cracking down and were threatening to just institute a pause in payments, Corinthian had to fold and move towards bankruptcy right away. Because, once again, these are pass-throughs set up by hedge fund operators. And the reason for their existence is just to move the money from the federal government into the coffers of Wall Street.
Right.
And they don't have great reserves. They just channel the money to the rich folks.
Yeah, and we're not the only ones talking about this, Glenn, because I know on Capitol Hill you have Senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, and Elijah Cummings, Representative Cummings of Baltimore, really. They came out with a letter, and they were asking and calling for more oversight. Is that correct?
Yeah, calling for more oversight, and Dick Durbin was actually calling for the heads of these organizations. He sounded like an abolitionist. He has pointed out that $32 billion a year that goes from federal accounts straight through these for-profits and then, of course, onto Wall Street, $32 billion is equivalent to the ninth largest federal agency. That is, it is a big, a significant chunk of federal funding. Now, Durbin said it was the equivalent of a federal agency. I'm saying, well, why isn't there a federal agency, one that is set up specifically to serve the needs of this population that clearly has not been served by the traditional educational establishment, of this population that was forced through desperation because nobody else was providing a service at all, would let them in, was forced into the hands of these, these corporate criminals who ripped them off. At most of these schools, you're lucky if 50% of the students graduate, but they still owe money. Of those 50% or so that might graduate, they are lucky if they get a job that pays anything close to enough to pay back the student loan.
And Glenn, when we're talking about these students, most of them are parents, is that right?
This is a much older demographic than your traditional student. These are people who want to improve their lives. They are hopeful. They believed the old maxim that education changes everything, and they stake their futures on it. Many of them are in middle age. They're scattered around the place. These are hopeful and aspiring people, and it is doubly cruel that they should have their hopes crushed by these evil criminal organizations at a later stage in life. But what is also evil is that there was no place else for them to go. There is no cabinet department with $32 billion that is saying, damn, all these black folks and brown folks really want an education. Let's try to provide it for them, since it's quite clear that the existing institutions won't do it.
All right. That gives you a lot of food for thought next time you see one of those commercials, University of Phoenix commercials. Glenn Ford, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News Network.
Wow. Yep. As you guys just heard, some fascinating news. I must say, the very idea that the education system can be used in such a manner for funneling funds and, you know, totally laundering money, and it's considered illegal, is should be outrageous to many. So it was. I thought this story was definitely an eye-opener, especially for those who may be thinking about some of those schools that were listed. I know personally there's been moments when I've looked at refreshing classes and I came across Phoenix and looked at it. I tell you what. Now that I'm more informed regarding what's happening there, it definitely won't be one of those places that I keep on my use, my list for refreshers. Interesting thing in the news, also, predatory capitalism, old trends and new realities is the headliner. I thought this was a pretty interesting story. This one we found on truthout.org. It says, in seeking to understand the nature of contemporary capitalism, it is important to realize that the whole is indeed greater than the sum of its parts. It is also pertinent that we recognize the importance of structural causality in making sense of contemporary capitalism. Developments while avoiding methodological reductionalism, that's in trying to come to terms with the nature of the beast at hand, capitalist system running amok. We need to look at the overall structure of the system. That is, we need to comprehend the different constitutive parts of the system that keep it together and running in ways which are harmful to the interests of the great majority of the population, dangerous to democracy and public values, and detrimental to the environment and Earth's ecosystem. Focusing on the element of the system while ignoring other things, perhaps because we think that they constitute incidental outcomes or processes of secondary nature, may limit our understanding by creating a flawed perspective about the dynamics and the contradictions of contemporary capitalism, and thereby undermine our ability to propose sound and realistic solutions. In considering the central question, why Contemporary capitalism pursues goals which benefit almost exclusively big capital and the rich. This is the underlying issue behind virtually all recent studies dealing with inequality. It should be clear from the outset that capitalism as a socio-economic system is neither egalitarian nor democratic. Capitalism is not an economic system designed to cater to the needs of the common folk and left to its own devices, especially the financial component, and it can wreak havoc on society. That's for the so-called trickle-down theory, or the horse and sparrow theory, as John Kenneth Galbraith referred to it. It is nothing more than a propaganda tool used by those who seek to justify policies favoring the rich. Capitalism represents a specific, historically determined mode of production. It is a ruthless economic system representing the most advanced form of commodity production. In this system, the extraction of profit is the driving force of capitalist commodity In this system, the extraction of profit is the driving force of capitalist commodity production, with exploitation and inequality representing structural necessities. Wow, that's a lot, you guys. Capital itself is nothing but a sort of self-expanding value that is value that generates surplus value. The production of surplus value is the fundamental law of capitalism. Capitalist production has its objective aim and goal not the production of use values as such, but rather that of surplus value. Under capitalism, it is, of course, the workers themselves who create new value, which is greater than the value of their labor power. This is the essence of the surplus value. Capital acclimation and an anarchic and contradictory process, the logic of accumulation of capital leads to enormous wealth. There is no other known economic system which can match capitalism's inherent capacity to generate wealth. On the other hand, and to the relative impoverishment of the working population on the other, unemployment is a structural element of capitalism. The manifold activities of capitalist accumulation also tend to accelerate the process of the concentration and centralization of capital, eventually giving rise to the dominance of finance capital and to the emergence of financialization as a possible new stage in the evolution of capitalism. Capitalism is an expansionist socio-economic system. Capitalist expansion has taken place in the course of history via different venues, ranging from plunder and exploitation through trade to investment in industry and the financialization of assets. There is no point in going into details here about the history of global capitalism, but suffice to say that capitalism has a long and brutal history of expansion, exploitation, and injustice, dating back to the 15th century and to the subsequent rise of imperial powers across Europe and North America, with the subjugation and the exploitation of people and resources from the periphery providing the growth engine for the economies of the imperial centers. It is only in the post-war era that the most destructive tendencies of capitalism are contained, at least inside the advanced capitalist economies. Thanks to the spread of progressive economic thinking, the influence of socialism, and the power exerted by trade unions. However, since the late 1970s, capitalism is seeking to return with a vengeance to its cruel, brutal, and barbaric past by breaking the social contract and intensifying the rate of exploitation in order to shift increasing greater amounts of wealth from the bottom to the top. Starting from the bottom, now we're here. A study released in early 2014 by British humanitarian group Oxfam International shows that the richest 1% has 65 times the total wealth of the bottom half of the population. I mean, that is very significant. That's very significant. Stating the case of inequality in more dramatic terms, the report reveals that the richest 85 individuals on the planet share combined wealth that is equal to that owned by the bottom half of the world's population. Along with the increasing inequality, mass unemployment is once again displaying itself as an intrinsic feature of capitalism, and poverty rates are sharply on the rise. There is a consensus that today's young people in the Western world will be worse off than their parents' generation. Why is capitalism fouling things up again by returning to the more ugly practices of the past? Is it because today's capitalists are greedier than those of the past? Even if we assume that this rather silly suggestion is true, greed alone can hardly explain away why capitalism is running amok in our own time. For a convincing answer to the question of why capitalism has embarked on a journey back toward the future, and perhaps in the process is making the money class even greedier, we need to come to terms with the structural changes in the operation of the capitalist economy. Contemporary capitalism is characterized by a political economy which revolves around finance capital. It is based on a savage form of free market fundamentalism and thrives on a wave of globalizing processes and global financial networks that have produced global economic oligarchies with the capacity to influence the shaping of policymaking across the nations. As such, the landscape of contemporary capitalism is shaped by three interrelated forces: financialization, neoliberalism, and globalization. All three of these elements constitute part of a coherent whole which has given rise to the entity called predatory capitalism. Under this system, as Henry A. Gurix has consistently pointed out, democracy and the social state are under constant attack, and citizens are now reduced to data, consumers, and commodities. Wow, that is amazing. In this regard, Pope Francis hit the nail on the head when he described today's capitalism as a new tyranny. Today's brand of capitalism is particularly anti-democratic and simply incapable of functioning in a way conducive to maintaining sustainable and balanced growth. By waging the most vicious class war in the entire post-war period, the economic elite and their allies have managed to roll back progress on the economic and social fronts by resurrecting the predatory free market capitalism that eviscerated millions in the early 20th century, while a handful of obscenely wealthy individuals controlled the bulk of the wealth. As indicated in the report on inequality by Oxfam International cited earlier, evidence in support of this dramatic state of affairs has been growing for a number of years. And the latest work to underscore this point, Thomas Piketty's publishing sensation, Capital in the 21st Century, does it with such powerful impact that, as Paul Krugman said, writing in the New York Review of Books, it may very well change both the way we think about society and the way we do economics. But let's take things from the start. The capitalist order we have in place today has its roots in the structural changes that took place in the accumulation process back in the mid to late 1970s. The 1970s was a decade of economic slowdown and inflationary pressures in the advanced capitalist world. The crisis brought about by new technology innovations, declining rates of profit, and the dissolution of the social structures of accumulation that had emerged after World War II led to the sluggish growth rates, high inflation, and even higher rates of unemployment, bringing about a phenomenon that came to be known as stagflation. From policy point of view, stagflation signaled the end of an era in which there was a trade-off between inflation and unemployment, shown by the Phillips curve, and by extension, the end of the dominance of the Keynesian school of thought. As with all other capitalist crises in the past, the crisis of the 1970s compelled capital and the economic elite to restructure the way the capitalist economy had functioned up to that time. The restructuring process unfolded in several ways, which included, among other things, increasing the pace of market liberalization, attacking the traditional welfare state and the interest of the unionized workers, in an attempt to eliminate social programs and suppress wages and create greater flexibility in the labor market, respectively, and initiating a new wave of globalization under the aegis of both industrial and financial capital. The new economic orthodox, which came to be known as the Washington Consensus, called for open markets, deregulation, privatization, labor flexibility, short-term optimization as a more attractive way to ensure competition and growth, low taxation for corporations and the rich, and a minimum welfare state. The desire was to return to an era in which capitalism functioned unfettered by government and social constraints. In other words, back to the age when capital grew by running roughshod over labor. Indeed, a counter-revolution was underway, and in it seemed to be global in nature and scope. The radical paradigm shift in economics was taking place in highly diverse economic environments, ranging from Chile under Augusto Pinochet's reign of terror to liberal democracies in the Anglo-Saxon world and the United Kingdom under Margaret Thatcher, and in the United States under Ronald Reagan, and to communist China under Deng Xiaoping. By the mid-1980s, most capitalist nations around the world, including many Western European countries with long traditions with social democratic policies, had shifted from Keynesianism to neoliberalism. The march to economic freedom, which is how the neoliberal counter-revolution was celebrated by arch-conservative thinkers such as Thomas Sowell, for example, captivated by the nonsense of Austrian economics, did not take place on the basis of some abstract entity known as the free market. On the contrary, it required active intervention by the capitalist state across society and the economy. Indeed, how else was the welfare state going to be reduced and the power of the labor unions weakened? How else could policies be introduced that increased the upwards flow of income, created new investment sites, promoted a new wave of privatization, and permitted banks and other financial institutions to practice financial chicanery? How else could failed financial institutions be bailed out with public funds if governments and elected officials had not been turned into minions of the money class? The capitalist state everywhere resorted to the use of both hard, i.e. repression, and soft propaganda power in order to secure the transition to the new economic and social order commanded by finance capital and big business interests. International organizations such as the International Monetary Fund, also known as the IMF, and the World Bank, but also countless non-governmental NGOs, organizations throughout the world, were mobilized for the promotion of this goal. The corporate-owned mainstream media and the overwhelming majority of academics and intellectuals also joined the show as cheerleaders of the neoliberal vision. In sum, the return to predatory capitalism was prompted by a crisis in the workings of the post-war capital regime, and realized through active political intervention, i.e. class politics, by the capitalist state and international organizations, and the support provided by the intellectual elite and mass media. The three pillars on which contemporary capitalism is structured around, financialization, neoliberalism, and globalization, need to be understood on the same basis of a structural connectivity model. Although it is rather incorrect to reduce one from the other, let me explain. The surge of financial capital long predates the current neoliberal era, and the financialization of the economy takes place independently of neoliberalism. Although it is greatly enhanced by the weakening of regulatory regimes and the collusion between finance capital and political officials that prevails under the neoliberal order. Neoliberalism, with its emphasis on corporate power, deregulation, the marketization of society, the glorification of profit, and the contempt for public goods and values, provides the ideological and political support needed for financialization of the economy and the undermining of the real economy, thus challenging neoliberalism, a task of Herculean proportions, given the virtually every aspect of the economy and of the world as a whole, from schools to the workplace and from post offices to the IMF, functions today on the basis of neoliberal premises, does not necessarily imply a break on the financialization processes underway in contemporary capitalist economies. Financialization needs to be tackled on its own terms, possibly with alternative finance systems and highly interventionist policies, which include the nationalization of banks rather than through regulation alone. In any case, what is definitely needed in order to constrain the destructive aspects of financial capitalism is what the late American heterodox economist Heming Minsky referred to as big government. We shall return to Minsky later in this analysis. Now, the surge of finance capital can be traced at least since the beginning of the 20th century in a major study addressing the economic characteristics of the latest phase of capitalist development published in 1910, Rudolf Hilferding, an Austrian-born Marxist economist and main theoretician for the Social Democratic Party of Germany during the Weimar Republic, devoted special attention to the process of the concentration and centralization of capital and outlined the theory of imperialism as a necessary development in the evolution of capitalism. In the course of this process, he also made it clear that systematic investigations of the role of money and credit, the expansion of the capitalist enterprise into corporations and their conversions into corporations was of the outmost importance for the understanding of the evolution of capitalism. Hilferding demonstrated that the rise of industrial corporations reflect an objective change in the function of industrial enterprise. The industrial corporation or the joint stock company allows anyone in possession of money to become a money capitalist. In effect, the Hilferding was observing the phenomenon of separatism of ownership of capital from control in the joint stock company. According to him, this process not only accelerated the concentration of capital, but also providing the joint stock company with the ability to expand far more rapidly than the individual owned enterprise, thereby leading to the centralization of capital. For Hilferding, however, it was the emergence of financial institutions and banks in particular that truly intensified the process towards concentration. He stressed that in the mature stage of capitalism, banks, which were quite necessary to the growth of industry, have become fully dominant and directly controlled the economic life of the system. Through its vast resources of liquid capital, banks were able to obtain control of major trusts in the industry. Since the latter needed idle capital in order to increase and expand the production process. Viewed from this perspective, industrial capital would be inextricably intertwined with bank capital and wholly dependent on money capital. The merging process between industrial and banking capital gives rise to a new form of capital, finance capital. Moreover, the establishment of an intimate relationship between banking capital and industrial capital results in an increased tendency toward the export of capital. The concentration of capital, which leads to monopolization, encourages the export of capital by virtue of the fact that the overaccumulation of capital can no longer find profitable investment opportunity at home. While it is true that Hilferding mistakenly considered the dependence of industrial capital on banking capital as a permanent state of affairs, the great monopolistic corporations became independent of banking capital, and today's large corporations use their own retained profits to finance investment. There can be no mistake that the transition from the domination of capital in general to the domination of finance capital emerged as a key feature of modern capitalism even before the outbreak of World War I. Indeed, the Great Depression of the 1930s revealed in the unmistakable terms the extent to which finance and financial capitalism had taken central stage, reshaping in a profound way the United States economy and affecting dramatically developments across the world. While Hilferding, Lenin, and many other Marxist thinkers provided important insights regarding the evolution of capitalism, the significance of financial arrangements in modern capitalism was scrutinized and analyzed most insignificantly and more thoroughly, perhaps, than anyone else in the post-war period by the American heterodox economist Hyman Minsky. Although he focused purely on the domestic economy, Minsky based his analysis on the claim that financial capitalism is inherently unstable, leading inevitably to financial crises as those produced by the stock market crash of 1929, relying on both empirical observations and theoretical analysis. Minsky underscored the point that the financial component of capitalism was the single most important aspect behind capitalism's inherent tendencies toward crisis. Building upon Kinney's general theory, Minsky wrote, "The capital development of a capitalist economy is accompanied by exchanges of present money for future money. The present money pays for resources that go into the production of investment output, whereas the future money is the profits which will accrue to the capital asset-owning firms as the capital assets are used in production. As a result of the process by which investment is financed, the control over items in the capital stock by producing units is financed by liabilities. These are commitments to pay money at dates specified or as conditions arise. For each economic unit, the liabilities on its balance sheet determine a time series of prior payment commitments, even as the assets generate a time theories, conjectured cash receipts. In this manner, in a capitalist economy, the past, the present, and the future are linked not only by capital assets and labor force characteristics, but also by financial relations. The key financial relationship link the creation and the ownership of capital assets to the structure of financial relations and changes in the structure. Institutional complexity may result in several layers of intermediation between the ultimate owners of the community's wealth and the units that control and operate the community's wealth. Minsky's analysis of financial capitalism clearly points the way to the development of the financialization of the economy. In the modern world, analysis of financial relations and their implications for system behavior cannot be restricted to the liability structure of businessmen and the cash flows they entail. Households, by the way of their ability to borrow on credit cards for big-ticket consumer goods such as automobiles, house purchases, and to carry financial assets, governments with their large floating and funded debts and international units, as a result of internationalization of finance, have liability structures which the current performance of the economy either validates or invalidates, consistent with both Marx's and King's analysis. And in spite of the greater complexity of financial relations, Minsky treats profit as a key detriment of system behavior, with aggregate demand determining profits. In Minsky's analysis, the role of banks as profit-seeking is inevitable. In fact, institutions is granted special attention, noting that banks realize the importance of innovation in the pursuit of profits. He calls bankers merchants of debt who strive to innovate in the assets they acquire and the liabilities they market, thus rejecting the orthodox quantity theory in which the circulation of money is treated as constant. Minsky identified three distinct financing positions: hedge, speculative, and Ponzi. Hedge financing units are those that can fulfill all of their contractual payment obligations by their cash flows. The greater the weight of equity financing in the liability structure, the greater the likelihood that the unit is a hedge financing unit. Speculative finance units are units that can meet their payment commitments on income amount account on their liabilities, even as they command repay the principal out of income cash flows. Such units need to roll over their liabilities, issue new debt to meet commitments on maturing debt. Governments with floating debt, corporations with floating issues of commercial paper, and banks are typical hedge units. For Ponzi units, the cash flows from operations are not sufficient to fulfill either the repayment of the principal or the interest due on outstanding debts by their cash flows from operations. Such units can sell assets or borrow, borrowing to pay interest or selling assets to pay interest, and even dividends on common stock lowers the equity of a unit, even as it increases liabilities in the prior commitment of future income. A unit that Ponzi finances lowers the margin of safety that it offers the holders of its debt. This description of lending is closer to the real world of finance that leads to crisis than anything available in the existing literature. For Minsky, It is the stability in the system that breeds instability as investors. Banks and financial institutions become complacent and began to embark on a riskier approach, which results in rising asset prices and eventually financial crashes when people begin to sell en masse upon the realization that the accumulated debt cannot be paid off. The development is known as a Minsky moment. Minsky's financial instability hypothesis provides a useful explanation of financial crisis, but also carries practical consequences. Essentially, Minsky felt that the internal contradictions of financial capitalism could be constrained by the establishment of strong institutions. He argued that the reason there have been no financial crises in the first few decades of the post-war era was because of the presence of big government. The task of stabilizing financial capitalism's inherent tendencies towards instability has clearly been severely undermined since the onset of the neoliberal era, with the global financial crisis of 2008 to 2009 representing just the latest act in a long series of financial crises since 1966. And with each new crisis getting bigger and becoming more severe than the previous one, yet it is equally clear that financial crises have occurred prior, and I do mean prior to the installation of a neoliberal regime. Moritz Scholarik of the Free University of Berlin identified more than 70 systematic banking crises that took place in the past 140 years prior to the global financial crisis of 2008 to 2009. Moreover, because of the globalization, big government action is restrained, and the challenges posed to central banking from globalized finances are quite severe, with financial globalization leading to growing frequency and severity of systematic financial crisis. Thus, globalization is in itself a contributing factor to the spread of financial crisis, while also providing a greater impetus for the deepening of neoliberalism. Although finance is at the forefront of globalization, listen, there is hardly an aspect of contemporary life that is not affected by globalization. Make it a very elusive concept indeed, while adding new levels of complexity to the task of finding appropriate economic and political responses to a system bent on instability and prone to large-scale crisis. Globalization creates new systematic risks, which we are simply uncertain how to address given the existing power structure in the global political economy, where a plutocracy reigns supreme as national governments have capitulated to the whims of the corporate and financial and the formal global governance structure needed to missing. Is missing. Yet, this is precisely the environment that makes predatory capitalism thrive. And one can be certain that it is insatiable. Its insatiable appetite for more and more profits will not only intensify problems in the years ahead, it is not stopped. If it is not stopped. Unsurprisingly, given how dysfunctional and dangerous the neoliberal order has proven to be, proposed solutions for the problems stemming from unfettered capitalism are not in short supply. They extend from short-range proposals for tax reform in order to close the gap between rich and poor, and medium-range goals, re-regulation, and even nationalization, to some rather long-range structural reforms, redesigning the architecture of the global financial system. The Stiglitz report, Joseph Stiglitz, for those who are up on that particular economist, you know, the guy that made Too Big, I mean, It Won't Fail, is a prime example of the latter set of proposals. Controlling climate change also represents a long-range goal. In fact, of vital importance for the stability of any future social and economic order. Nevertheless, proposals for major reforms that fail to incorporate the vision of alternative social orders must be treated with skepticism. The same goes for approaches that rely purely on reforms undertaken by the elite without citizen involvement and participation. By the same token, progressive forces bent on social change must re-embrace fundamental political principles and courses of social action. Building and sustaining a mass movement remains the best route to challenging the practices of predatory capitalism. However, progressive forces need to stop being constantly on the defensive in order to protect basic and fundamental values from neoliberal jackals and vultures, and seek instead to sharpen strategic abilities in order to go on the offense. Narrow ideological blinders must be dropped, and joining forces with kindred groups is an absolute necessity in today's world. Theoretically, we need an eclectic political economic approach which relies on Marxian, Keynesian, and post-Keynesian traditions in order to understand contemporary capitalist developments. There are no intellectual giants in the neoliberal tradition. We will need to look to Marx, Keynes, and Minsky for great insights, among others, into the true workings of capitalism. On the political front, the task of recapturing the state would seem to be necessary, a necessary first step in the drive. And I do mean necessary. The drive of any progressive movement or political party seeking to reestablish balance in the relationship between labor and capital. Now, resurrect democracy, redress the social injustice, and reorient the economy towards sustainable and balanced growth. Still, such undertakings are likely to fail if they are pursued or persuaded in the absence of a solid understanding of the nature of the current system and without having captured the public imagination. With ignorance of political and social developments and activist practice in other advanced capitalist countries and elsewhere around the world, and without a vision towards a new global order, not a new world order. A long-term vision should not stand in the way of pursuing immediate reforms that alleviate human pain and suffering. And short-term goals should not block the imagination from opening up a world of new possibilities from human relations. As stated in the articles before, have made clear, a major advantage that predatory capitalism has over alternative social orders, especially in the direction of a truly democratic future, where the economic system produces wealth for the benefit of society as a whole, is that it has managed to break free from national government control, shift the balance of power between labor and capital overwhelmingly towards the latter, establishing ideological hedge money, and globalize the environment in which it operates. The future of progress, social order, progressive social order, I'm sorry, orders, probably requires nothing short of the reversal of these trends. I mean, is fascinating to many of us. And I ask those to listeners, to trolls, to those who have consciousness even, to open your minds, remove the blinders, and go beyond your preference or personalized ideology. May we go beyond our personal experiences in our limited library of documents and historical articles and various artifacts that we've entrusted and invested ourselves in. Personally, I'm not impressed by press of preferences or perspectives that are invested in closed-minded assumptions. I am not impressed by egotistical buffers, gross intellectualism, and so-called academic accelerated amazement. I am not impressed by scholarly-like content or so-called well-read individuals. I like to look beyond that, look at open hearts and open minds. Those who continue and remain and attempt to be objective, not limiting themselves by the left or the right wing or the few blogs that they come across that feeds into their theories and hypocrisy, and sometimes their conspiracy theories. But to go beyond the surface level of thought, the surface level of their intellect, shifting paradigms beyond that 1, 2, 3, maybe 20% usage of the brain in their consciousness, beyond our age and the amount of time we've lived on this earth, beyond the experiences that we've championed, beyond our accomplishments and our accolades, beyond our material assets or our academic achievements or accolades, I challenge people to go beyond that, to go beyond limitations, limiting themselves off of class or ethnicity, limiting themselves off of the house culture, whether it's racism or bigotry that's embedded in their culture, limited by the your color, my color idea in embracing this whole, these various concepts of conflicting hues. By building these bridges, build bridges instead of these barriers and barricades that ignite these fossils of dead ideas that people continue to spew out is sickening. I think there's time for an awakening of consciousness, an opening of the minds and hearts, any willingness to go beyond preferences and being judgmental, beyond the limitations of our ideologies, beyond the limitations of how we were raised, where we grew up around, and all of these various things, beyond the bigotry, beyond the racism, beyond the horse and pony show, beyond the tomfoolery and the trolling. But I challenge that to those who are willing, not to those who remain close-minded, to those who are open, not those who will remain to stay in and dwell in their ignorance, to those who can go beyond their preference, those who can go beyond surface-level politics and the so-called right-wing, left-wing ideology when they're both the same people? Because I am unimpressed by your discussions of Democrat and Republican when they're the same people, funded by Lobbyists Incorporated, funded by the elite, funded by the money changers, funded by those who have been deemed as the 1% in times, the controllers, the New World Orders, and so on. I'm not impressed by these comical personalities, these nuances of limbos, these imitators of Charlie Rose, you know, these artificial versions of CNN, and these people who continue to spew out the typical rhetoric. Obama this, Republican that, Democrat that. It's not impressive. It's not insulting. It's sad, comical. Unfortunately, those same puppets and clowns who do that for a living, they get a paycheck for that. How about you? I'm amazed at trolls who spend 24-hour shifts hopping on BTR shows from show to show, who actually have that type of that level of time on their hands. It's saddening. It's saddening to me when you have that type of time on your hand to spend idly while others are building and growing and evolving, focusing on ideas and joining up, coming to one or two shows and going to do something and putting action into the universe, not just dying with their ideas, but actually taking those ideas beyond. I heard something that was very impressive. It was talking about a tombstone. That on a tombstone, there's the day in which you was born, the day in which you died, and in between is the dash. And the question is, what will your dash mean? What will your dash say? What will your legacy be? Will your legacy be unrecorded trolling that's insignificant, that no one will remember? Because along with you, your death, the platform that you use will be dead? Or will you have a legacy that speaks volumes of the people you loved, the causes you championed, the communities you helped, the neighborhoods you built, the investments you made, the lives you healed, the lives you saved, the people you influenced, the cities you inspired, the nations that you hired, the buildings, the blocks, the cities, the families that you built up, the people that you reach back to who were falling in the ashes like those drowning in the flood, and you lifted them out from that moment, that very second to where they almost tasted death, only to experience life again, but now life renewed. As I started, I end. As I said in the beginning, I and we are fortunate and privileged to be descendants of a rich lineage and royal blood. on this very day, I celebrate the spirit of our ancestors and the heritage of past and present day elders, patriarchs and matriarchs, Africa to the Caribbean, to Asia, and even Europe. I thank you to the veterans and to the sharecroppers, farmers and blue collar workers, the governors of the households, also known as housewives and household fathers, the single mothers and fathers, the teachers and griots who record and teach our stories today, even now, to the entrepreneurs and builders, and everyone yet to be mentioned, thank you for all that you've done and continue to do. The builders of pyramids, pioneers of math and science, the innovators and inventors, historians and architects, authors, painting vivid images of reality for us, and physicians healing us with the nutrients of the earth and remedies passed down through generations. Thank you, Mother Africa. Thank you for birthing iconic founders of complex civilizations. Thank you, Mother Africa, for building and creating revolutionary culture to this day. Thank you, Mother Africa, for the innovative technologies that transcend the barriers of timelines, the nuances now in the times and space as we know it, in the stratosphere. May you receive the credit that is due you sooner than later. The sweetest taste of your proverbs, the echoes of your wisdom, your spirit, and nature still consume us like a mighty rushing wind today. We thank you, Mother Africa. Thank you for feeding us, raising us up out of the dead ideas that were stripped away from us when we were brought here on those boats, when we were shipped to the Hades, to the Bahamas, to the Caribbeans, the Jamaicas, to the Puerto Ricos, in the Dominican Republics. Thank you, Mother Africa, for showing us the importance and the value of loving man on woman and woman on man, procreation the right way. Thank you, Mother Africa, for showing us how to build the village, how to celebrate our heritage, how to be a true community. Thank you, Mother Africa, for the very breath I breathe today. Thank you, Mother Africa, for opening my eyes to from dead ideas that were wasted. Thank you, Mother Africa, for delivering me from the brainwash and the confusion and the falsehoods of illusions that pervade us today. Thank you, Mother Africa, for inspiring me, for encouraging me, for giving me big and bold shoulders to stand on, to lift my chest and poke it out with pride and say, I am a descendant of kings and queens. I am a descendant of rich and royal blood. I am a descendant of queens and kings. I am a descendant of beautiful women whose hues come in manyfold, rich as the darkness of the richest and wealthiest oil that countries pillage and fight countries and grab land over today. It's the same richness of that hue, of that darkness that we see in oil. It's happening with our women. Thank you, Mother Africa, for helping me to understand why people fight to make negative images of our women, to make it seem normal, to disrespect our women, to call them all types of B's, all types of H's, to downplay their wounds, to rape them, to disregard them, and to exalt other women above the mothers of civilization, the queens whose blood is connected to the richness and the heritage of royalty? What an audacity. Thank you, Mother Africa, for exalting your warrior spirit but also the essence of your class. I see it in the strength of our athletes. I see it in the class, in the finesse of our women. I see the contextualized beauty in the faces of the varying hues all over, the strength in our hair, the length of our locks. Oh, man, the beauty of the curves. Thank you, Mother Africa, for showing us what it means to be. Just be. Be great. Be phenomenal. Be dominant. To be unstoppable. To influence, to set trends. I mean, thank you, Mother Africa. It's the reason why I like to walk my walk, feeling like Denzel, and talk my talk, and turn up. Thank you, Mother Africa, to show me why people run into those saunas to darken their skin so they can get the same, they want the melanin that we have. Why they inject their lips so they can be full like ours. So they can shake their eyelids and cut them open so they can be wide like ours. Yeah. So they can wear locks like we do. So they can inject their butts so they can be as curvaceous as our women. Thank you, Mother Africa, for reminding us with your rich and great wealth. You remind us why the wars take place. People are fighting to run to Africa, everybody, but those who are asleep, because they understand the oil, the gold, the diamonds, the people. They understand it. It's a reason why they came to Africa. That wasn't an accident. It's a reason why people are perplexed by the pyramids today, still trying to figure it out. So I say in closing, thank you, Mother Africa, for all that you've done and all you continue to do. And I'm excited about next show. Love and hugs to everyone in the chat room and those who try to get on the phone lines. You subscribers and archivers listening to the show later on, without you guys, none of this would be possible. Remember to come back and tune in tomorrow, same time, same BTR channel. Enjoy the remainder of your day. May it be peaceful and joyous for you. And that's it. Show is over. Close the curtains, exit the building, another chapter in the book. Until next time, I bid you have a joyous and peaceful day.